The report of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services on the annual performance plans 21-22 of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, National Prosecuting Authority, Legal Aid South Africa, Special Investigative Unit, Public Protector South Africa, South African Human Rights Commission and Information Regulator, and Budget Vote 25, Justice and Constitutional Development. Can we go on page one? Can we go to page one, Committee Secretary? Page two. Page three. Page three, page four.
Chair Wilma.
Honorable Newport Drachen.
Let me just check 4.1.
4.1.
I think there's a double word there. I'm just going to check if it's still there. Let me just read. Yeah, the last line of 4.1 of these.
Yes. Thank you very much, Honorable Nilbo Drachen. Can you go to page four? Page five. Page six. Page seven. Page eight.
Chair.
Honorable Nivo Trachan.
8.2.1. Okay. Go up a bit. I'm just checking. There seems to be two brackets, like including magistrate salaries is in brackets, and then compared with is also in brackets. So the first bracket, I think, should stay, and then there should be a comma, and then those two last brackets should be removed.
Yes. Ms. Silverstone, can you attend to that?
Yes, I have.
Yes, thank you. Page 9, page 10. Page 11. Page 12.
Sorry, Chair.
Honorable Board
10.2. The eighth bullet.
Yes. Starting with providing facilities, is that the one?
Let me just check. Yeah, providing facilities. Service point. Not PINTS, I think. Providing facilities at courts and justice service PINTS. It should be points.
Points, yes. Ms. Sousto, can you attend to it?
I've done it.
Thank you. Clarification.
Chair.
Honorable Newt.
10.4. The first bullet. Causing in disruption of system. Yes. That in should be.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Can you remove the in?
It's done.
Thank you. 15.14.
Page 15, Chair.
15, yes.
11.1.5.
The administration program.
The second line, 202, it just needs to be in terms compared to 202. So there's a number missing.
Yes.
There's no zero.
Yes. Can you attend to that? Yes, looks done. Did you see it?
Yes, it's done. I've done both.
Okay. Page 16. Page 17. Page 18.
Sorry, Chair.
Just
to go back to page 17, 11.3.3, the last line says, 23, 24, 22. So it just needs to be corrected in terms of the numbers.
Yes.
I think the 22 should be removed.
And Ms. Silkstone, can you attend to that?
It's done.
Thank you. 17, 18, 19.
Hey, sorry, 18.
18.
11.4.3. Crime is in a capital, as with a capital letter, it should just be small caps.
Okay. Thank you. 19. Twenty-one. 23, 24.
Chair, page 24. 12.8. The eighth bullet. No, sorry. Sorry, the fourth bullet.
At the end.
Yes, Sorry, just clarifying where exactly. The third last line, take out since, the word since. Demand has increased, the demand has increased since should be taken out. It's just the demand has increased despite legal aid.
Yes. Ms. Houston, have you taken care of that?
Yes, I've done it.
Okay. 25.
Sorry, Chair.
Honorable Newbold.
13.8. The second line, the 71.5%, there's a T next to the percentage symbol. It needs to be removed.
Okay. Can you remove that, Ms. Houston?
It's done.
Okay. 28. Thirty-six. 37, 38, 39, 40. 41, 42, 43, 44, 45. 46, 47, 48, 49, 50.
Chair.
Honorable Nibotakhan.
21.2. And this is my last correction, but 21.2, the second line has, the has, there's no A between the H and the S.
Yes, thank you very much.
Sorry, there's another one. The sixth line, the brackets are in the wrong place, it seems.
Okay.
And the last line, resolve, is spelled incorrectly.
Mm.
And then I'm done, Chair.
Okay, again, thank you very much. Have you noted all of those issues in the system?
Yes, I've done them all.
Okay. 52, 53. Is there anyone who moves for the adoption of the report as corrected?
Well, my Honourable Neo Druchin moves for the adoption of the report as amended.
Honourable Neo Druchin moves for the adoption of the report as corrected. Is there any seconder?
I second, Chairperson.
Honourable Janji seconds. Is there anyone who objects to the report?
Chairperson, it's Werner Roll speaking. Not an objection, just a reservation, please.
Honourable Horn, on behalf of the Democratic Alliance, reserves. The report
from the ACDP side, just a reservation at this stage, thank you.
Honourable Stuart from the ACDP, also reserves. Honourable Yako.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I will also have to reserve my comments up until I've consulted with the caucus. Thank you.
Honourable Yako also reserves. The report is adopted. Thank you very much, members. Can we have a 2 minutes break as we invite the person who's going to make a presentation on domestic violence to upload the slides?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It's Robert's Department of Justice. I have uploaded the document. Hope everybody can see it.
Thank you very much and welcome. Is that Mr. Robertson?
That's correct, Mr. Chairperson, and hello members. I'm ready to proceed.
Thank you very much. You can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I want to sort out something on my screen. Previously, we were busy dealing with the definition of domestic violence. Certain comments were made in respect of certain provisions in that definition. I'm going to carry on where we stopped last time, and that relates to paragraph J of the definition of domestic violence. And it's more or less a catch-all provision that has been inserted or is to be inserted in the Domestic Violence Act to deal with any other not mentioned conduct in the definition to bring it within the ambit of the Domestic Violence Act. There's two aspects that needs to be raised here. First is it relates to a drafting issue. I have previously pointed out that the harm requirement as is currently provided for in the definition of domestic violence in the Domestic Violence Act provides that or requires that harm must ensue from conduct that relates to domestic violence, and that the redrafted clause in the bill actually took it out. And there were concerns, amongst others, by the Honourable Mr. Swart and others, that there need to be some kind of limiting provision or mechanism to ensure that the conduct that constitutes domestic violence is not unduly wide. The first paragraph J, that's option one, is more or less the adoption of the current provision in the bill. The second one is a further provision that we proposed, and so it's amongst others also proposed that the kind of conduct that constitutes domestic violence must be intimidating, threatening, abusive, degrading, or offensive or humiliating conduct that inspires harm. The second option, however, also do not deal with the harm requirement in respect of all the conduct. The third option is mainly adoption of option one and two, but it's correct the drafting oversight, and the clause at the bottom of paragraph J will ensure that will ensure that there must at least be some form of harm or inspiration of harm that may be caused to the complainant. Before I go on, I just want to make apologies for Advocate Mac, who's engaged in the other meeting. I hope Ms. Lillian Clark has joined. Both has got other meetings to attend. So I'm going to stop at paragraph at the bottom of option three of paragraph J. If there's any comment in this regard.
Members, any comment? So, Mr. Roberts, which one are you recommending? Are you recommending option three?
I will recommend option three, Mr. Chairperson.
Okay. Any comments, members, on option three?
Chairperson? Thank you, Chair. My apology for not raising my hands there. I'm still struggling. I see your photos there. I want to remove them. But good morning, colleagues. and our visitors. Chair, I think option three, to me, it really makes sense. Because when I check above the, I check these other ones, and most of the words have been inserted here on this one. For now, I think option three for me will do.
Thank you very much. Any other member? Honorable Horn?
Yes, Chair, I want to say a quick look, I would also say that quite possibly option three would give us the broadest option. Can Mr. Roberts just maybe, for the sake of looking at the implementation, just address us on other legislation and how our courts have dealt with the term reasonable belief, in terms of whether it assists our courts in a simple way to deal with possible criminal action. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Robertson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If one, among others, look at the Criminal Procedure Act, where it relates to search warrants, I believe the requirement is the reasonable suspicion that certain conduct has been committed before a search warrant can be issued. If one look at, amongst others, Section 40 of the Criminal Procedure Act, the requirement is reasonable suspicion that certain offences has been committed before a person can be arrested without a warrant. Reasonable suspicion, reasonable belief, etc., is qualifying criteria that can be added to certain conduct. I probably want to address this point in full later on, but the fact is that there must be some kind of minimum criteria that must be met before, amongst others, a warrant can be issued, etc. And that has been interpreted by the courts. So it is usually interpreted with a reference to factual situations that is placed before a court, and whether a court can then assume from that factual situations that the suspicion or belief is in effect reasonable. And that is reasonableness usually relates to the interpretation according to a reasonable man standard. That is, I probably cannot take it further at this stage, but I think in general that explains it. It's a minimum criteria, and objective criteria is used to evaluate whether it's a reasonable suspicion or a reasonable belief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Can we move to the next one?
Next one relates to economic abuse. It's one of the conduct that is included in the definition of domestic violence. Option one is the current definition in the bill. New definition has been proposed, which do affect certain amendments to the current one in the bill. And some of the amendments that are affected to this bill, amongst others, is that paragraph B is qualified to indicate that the disposal of household effects must be without a complainant's permission. New categories of conduct that has been included is contained in the proposed definition, paragraph C and D, amongst others, the use of financial resources of a complainant without a complainant's permission, or the coercing of a complainant to relinquish control over assets or income, or sign a legal document that will enable the complainant finances to be managed by another person. So it's more or less an extension of the option one, the definition of economic abuse currently in the bill, to include further conduct thereto, and obviously to qualify paragraph B with that requirement of without the complainant's permission. Okay, just stop there. Is there any comment? From the department side, I believe option two is probably a preferable option. It is in line with some definitions that, or not definitions, but conduct in legislation in Australian capital territories. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Horn.
Now, my apologies, Chair, it's an old hand.
Any comments, members? On option two of economic abuse? If there's no comment, I'll take it that for now we agree with option two. Is that fine?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you go to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Just want to indicate it's a preferred option if I finalize the bill. Previously, I was of the opinion that the definition of educator that's currently in the bill must be omitted from the bill due to the fact that the minister can, by notice in the Gazette, amongst others, specify certain functionaries. However, after I evaluated the definition of functionary, my approach actually changed, and I'm of the view that we probably need to retain the current definition of educator in the bill, but then also the other functionaries that is referred to in the definition of functionaries must then also be defined in the bill, and I will later on point out certain problems with that. So for all practical purposes, the definition of educator as is proposed and before the committee in the bill will therefore be retained. Is there anything in this regard?
Any comments? Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition relates to elder abuse as a form of domestic violence. Two options were previously proposed. The first one is the one that is in the current bill. Option two was a reference to elder abuse as defined in the Older Persons Act. However, I also, after evaluating everything else, came up with a further option, namely option three, that we probably don't need elder abuse as a form of domestic violence in the bill. If one look at, amongst others, the definition of elder abuse in the Older Persons Act, it is defined as any conduct or lack of appropriate action occurring within a relationship where there's the expectation of trust which causes harm or distress or is likely to cause harm or distress of an older person. That is then regarded as abuse of an elder person. One must remember that the elder person is for all practical purposes a complainant for purposes of the Domestic Violence Act, and any other conduct that is already defined in the definition of domestic violence is applicable to an elder person. My submission is that the current definition for purposes of the Domestic Violence Act is extremely vague. Due to the fact that it doesn't specify specific conduct that must cause harm or distress to an elder person. So for all practical purposes, all conduct can cause harm or distress. And it's mainly a subjective test that is applied here. My proposal is that we probably don't need elder abuse as a form of domestic violence, and that it can be omitted due to the fact that all the other conduct in the current definition of domestic violence is, in any case, applicable to an elder person. If one look at Section 33, amongst others, of the Elder Persons Act, it specify, amongst others, that physical harm and sexual abuse, which is already included in the definition of domestic violence, is part of elder abuse. So I will stop there for any comment. Thank you.
Honorable Nivo Trachmans.
Thank you, Chair. I think I would like elder abuse to stay in the bill because there was an issue, but I do, you know, I do acknowledge that, you know, the other kinds of abuse apply to elder persons, but I would prefer that the definition of elder abuse stay in the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think Honorable Volma covered me, Chairperson. I think it should stay. That one, to me, it's very wide also, like she says. On this one, it should specify. There has been so many occasions or incidents where elder people in particular, which are directed to them in particular, that are happening. And if it is like this, you know, even the elder person himself or herself will have to, you know, he will feel like he's not accommodated in the whole thing. And I'm not sure maybe how I am trying to motivate it, and then, but I'll come back later. Let me say I agree with Honorable Nivot on this matter, that it should stay, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Swart.
Chair, I hear what my colleagues are saying, and whilst it's not strictly necessary according to what Mr. Robertson says, I think if I hear what they are saying for reference, in this particular bill, it might be helpful to refer to the elder abuse as referred to in the Older Persons Act, where it is defined, so that should there be an incident of domestic violence involving an older person, that person doesn't have to go and consult the Older Persons Act, which they probably might not be aware of, but would here have the definition of elder abuse contained in the Domestic Violence Act. I think, therefore, that it's possibly something for us to consider keeping it, although it's not necessarily needed, but purely for reference purposes. And if that is the case, then I would suggest option two as a possibility, which makes it very clear, which cross-references the very clear elderly abuse in the other act. And I think I tend to agree with my colleagues that it will be just comprehensive here in one act, whilst the cross-references to another act.
Thank you very much. So we are saying that it must stay, and we are, for now, we're inclined to support option two.
Yes.
Robert,
yes, Chair. Yes,
thank you. Can you move to the next one? Mr. Robertson. Committee Secretary, can you check where is Mr. Robertson?
Okay, Chair. Mr. Chairperson, can you hear me? Mr. Chairperson?
Yes, we can hear you.
Sorry, I've got network problems on this side.
We're about to send police to go and fetch you.
Sorry, it happened previously. The definition of electronic communications relate to the conduct that amounts to harassment for purposes of the Domestic Violence Act. And there's two proposed definitions here. The first one is merely a reference to the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, which defines what is electronic communication. Second option is to more or less provide for a more readily adapted definition of electronic communications, which will then be electronic communications, which include information in form of anything. And but the main thing about this definition is that it must be disclosed by means of electronic communication service. The second option is mainly to ensure that a definition can readily be inserted in a piece of legislation, which can be used then to evaluate when it is electronic communication or whether it's not. My submission is that option two is probably a preferable option. It captures what is in the Electronic Communications Act, and it also captures what is in the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, Act 25 of 2000, where there's a long definition of electronic communications. So option two is, according to me, a more preferable option. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Jale.
Thank you, Chair. I think I would agree with him, but if he can explain line number three, where it says visual images, I want to know this moving images. What is that supposed to mean? Just for interest sake, just to know. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Moving images can, amongst others, be something like a comic that is placed on the internet, where there is something that's a picture that plays similar to a video, or can be used. I know it's on one hand, the line three already referred to video, but video is more or less something that is captured in electronic form of something that happens. But my submission is that something like, let's call it a comic or images that is used to make a kind of movie will be captured in my moving images. And obviously a picture is something else that is something, a picture of a person, a photo. I hope that explains it.
Can I come in? Do you mean something like it's a picture, but it's not something that is a live like video? It's a picture, maybe coming pictures are moving, like pictures are moving, different pictures like that. Is that supposed to mean? If I want to.
Well, if the members knows anime, Japanese comics. There's lots of movies that's actually made, which mainly consist out of art that is more or less drawn by a person, and they make up a whole movie with moving or images that's actually painted or drafted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robert. Honorable Horn.
Yes, Chair, maybe also to assist this thing that goes around even on WhatsApp, which is, I think the technical term for it is a GIF. The reality is if you download those, it is downloaded as an image, even though it is in reality something like a 2-second video. So I would think that moving images as a term in this is necessary also to encapsulate those types of graphics that are being used specifically on social media platforms like WhatsApp. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So members, are we happy with option 2?
Yes, Chair.
Honorable Wilma has her hand up, Chair.
Honorable Nubo Rahman.
Chair, what Honorable Horn has just said in relation to GIFs, I want to know then if in this definition memes are also covered. And, you know, TikTok videos where there is a lot of teasing and things like that. So would those be included in this current definition? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I believe almost all electronic presentations that's transmitted by means of electronic communication service would be covered here. First, it's voice. It's obviously when you talk. Even sound and the data is obviously something in electronic form. Text, something that's written. Video, I already explained. Animation extends it further, etc. So mines as well as TikToks, I think, will be included here. I cannot see that it can fall outside of this definition since it's extremely comprehensive. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The definition of Electronic Communications Act is merely to clarify it. The next definition is electronic communications identity number. The first option mainly tells you that it is a technical label which represents the origin and destination of electronic communication traffic. I haven't got a problem with that, but then it explains it further, amongst others, that it must be a logical and virtual identity number assigned to a customer, and explains, amongst others, the telephone number, etc. That forms part thereof. The other proposed definition is option 2 in the cleanup bill. It's merely to define it as a technical identification label, which represents the origin and destination of the electronic communications. One must remember that electronic communications identity number, the main purpose thereof is, amongst others, to identify from where the communication originated and also then the place to which it was transmitted. Included in electronic communications identity number, there's various other informations that can be obtained, amongst others, the date, time, duration of the communication, the service that is used, the equipment that is used, etc. And that is all part of the identifying technical information that is needed to ensure that the person can identify the origin or destination of electronic communication. My submission is that the second proposed definition is probably the one that should be used. I think in the cybercrimes bill, amongst others, really deals with certain malicious communications and protection orders in section 21.8, use the second option insofar as it relates to the information that's needed to identify a communication. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Chair.
No, Chair, I think it's my old hand. Thank you. Sorry.
Can you lower it? Thank you. Any comments, members? Can I take it that for now we are moving with option two?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you. Can you go? Thank you very much. Can we go to the next one, Mr. Robertson?
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition is electronic communications network. It's similar to the definition, or let me rather say it is the definition that is currently in the bill. It's retained. Electronic communication service is the current definition in the bill. No amendments there to. Electronic communication service provider in the bill, service provider. The definition refers to Electronic Communications Act and indicates that it is a person or entity who is either licensed or exempted from being licensed in terms of Chapter 3 of the Electronic Communications Act. If you look at the Electronic Communications Act, there's a definition of a private electronic communications network. And in, I think it was Section 6 of that Act, it provides, amongst others, that a license exemption can be granted in respect of a person that uses a private electronic communications network. Obviously, private electronic communications network can be used for purposes of domestic violence. It's like the internal Department of Justice electronic communication service, which on one hand do connect to the internet, but also allow communications to be transmitted internally. My submission is similar to the Cyber Crimes Act that we probably need to specifically provide or include a private electronic communications network that is used to transmit electronic communications in the bill to ensure that we cover that network as well as the person or the system administrator that is responsible for such network. This relates mainly, amongst others, to the obligations that is imposed later on in the bill, where assistance is required from an electronic communication service provider to identify the person that actually committed cyber harassment. So we either can use the current definition as is, but to be absolutely sure, may think thereof to include a private electronic communications network and the services provided through that in the bill for purposes of enforcement of the obligations later on that's placed on electronic communication service providers. I'm going to stop there.
And you? Any comments, members? No comments. We are fine. Yeah, you can proceed. Proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson, network. Next definition is emergency monitoring relief. And that relates to certain orders that a court can make in terms of a protection order. The current definition relates, amongst others, to losses suffered by a complainant. It is acknowledged that a complainant includes a child that is in the care of a complainant, but my submission is that we probably need to specifically make provision for maintenance that can be granted to a complainant, or rather that can be used for a child in a complainant's care. I know there is provisions in the Domestic Violence Act that already provide, amongst others, that the court may declare that the provisions of certain other legislation may be applicable as such for a certain period of time. However, to include it in emergency monitoring belief will specifically indicate that the needs of children that is in the care of a complainant is considered and taken into account. The current provision in section 77B of the Domestic Violence Act can then be used to an extent to restrict the ambit of the application of maintenance. So guidance is needed from the committee. More or less, must I specifically include a reference to maintenance for a child that is in the care of a complainant under this provision? Thank you.
Thank you, members. We have Honorable Nico Drachens, followed by Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Chair. For a moment, I missed where it said the court may what I had a network problem. If Mr. Robertson could just explain what he was saying, if the court may, I think it should be changed to the court must, because if a family is forced to leave and maybe go into a safe house, I mean, they're not going to have, you know, access. So if the court may, then it means the complainant and the child only may get assistance. So I think we should increase the emphasis to be the court must. I think it needs to be a stronger term there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to everybody. Honourable Chair, I'd like to differ from Ronipa Jochen. One doesn't easily prescribe to courts, and one doesn't easily interfere with the discretion of a court, and one must accept that the court will apply discretion judicially. So may doesn't mean if it feels like it, it means may if the circumstances warrant it. So I'm comfortable with may, but I do agree that Mr. Roberts should include such a clause. Thank you.
And should I take it that, members, we are comfortable with what Mr. Roberts is suggesting? The issue is the difference between may and must. Honorable Johannes, your issue is not is the issue of must, but you are generally comfortable with what is being proposed.
Yes, absolutely, Chair. I'm comfortable with the proposal. My question is with may or must, where Honourable Breytenbach and I differ. I think specifically for emergency purposes, it should be something that is a must and not something that, yeah, you understand.
What is the view of other members? Honourable Jela, followed by Honourable Swart.
Okay, Chair. I think I'm comfortable on the issue of including maintenance, because obviously it will be covering that there. It will be just like the first point that we were talking about in terms of reference, Chairperson. But on the issue of Honourable Bema, I understand, or maybe I just want to put myself on the shoes of Honourable Nivold Drachen on this issue, because this, okay, it may give an impression that we are dictating to the court, not giving them an option in terms of they are the ones who must use their own discretion. But sometimes on these issues, we have seen, without undermining the decisions of the court, but there's somewhere where we feel that we need to put words such as must, because considering the issues that we have been having, reports of some of our courts magistrate not being able to, you know, to put a very strong message when it comes to these issues. And issues of domestic violence, if we want to really take them serious as we want to right now, somewhere, somehow, we will have to really consider the issue of putting weights such as must. But I'll leave it to the colleagues when we come to the discussion to that point. Thank you, Chair.
Members, have we really considered the unintended consequences of limiting the discretion of the court? Honourable Swart?
No, Chair, I hear what the colleagues are saying, but I do think that we will run into constitutional problems and unintended consequences by prescribing to the court, bearing in mind that there are a number of items here that the court will need to discuss and consider.
Sorry, Honourable Swart, your voice is very low.
I'm going to just delete the I'm just saying there could be unintended consequences and constitutional problems as well if one prescribes to courts. The issues relating to colleagues, one would not want to go that route, but you could then appeal a judgment where the magistrate has acted incorrectly. But there are a number of items here that have to be considered by the court. So I would definitely say may, because I think that one will run into constitutional problems by prescribing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Drachens, are you still of the same view?
Yes, Chair. I still stand by my view, but perhaps when we go clause by clause, we'll see how it looks. The point is particularly, and the point of the bill is for women and the victims. So, you know, we don't want the courts or anybody putting more suffering on the victims. So that's the view. So I'm not saying it as, you know, we need to prescribe to the courts, but we really have to take into account the victims' experience and putting more onerous conditions on the victim. But I think we can discuss it a bit later when we see how the bill looks. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. When we come back to it next week, I think it's one area that we might come back to it. But let us not, we are doing clause by clause now. We will only come back to those issues where we think that, like this one, we might come back to it, but wherever we have agreed, we will not come back to reopen it. So we are doing clause by clause now, because next week it will be clean up, because it will be the last time that we will be dealing with this bill before they are approved by the House. So it's either members, we might come back to it when we are done today, or we will come back to it when we are just looking at only those issues where we have not been able to agree. But where we have passed, we have passed. Mr. Robertson, the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. Next one relates to domestic violence in the form of emotional, verbal, psychological abuse. I did explain previously that there's probably a need to include manipulating or threatening or humiliating conduct in the current definition. And in option one, I did include certain additional grounds that may amount to emotional, verbal, or psychological abuse. Option two is a more comprehensive definition of emotional or psychological abuse. I want to refer that the reference to harm here, as I highlight now, may be excluded from this definition if there is absolute consensus that harm can be included in the definition of domestic violence. Option two list various other grounds of conduct that relate to emotional or psychological abuse, amongst others, willful damaging or destruction of property in close vicinity of a complainant, obviously to scare a complainant, to harm or threaten harm to a household pet or other animal, to disclose a complainant's sexual orientation or other private information, to threaten a complainant with the death or injury of another person or damage of another person's property, or threats to commit suicide or self-harm. I believe option two is more comprehensive, more inclusive of what conduct can be regarded as this form of domestic violence. Obviously, it will then also be qualified to an extent by the harm requirement that may be imposed in option three of the proposed amendment to paragraph J of the definition of domestic violence. Thank you.
I'm going to stop you. Thank you, members. Honorable Breitenberg.
Sorry.
Can members immediately after speaking lower their hands so that we don't become confused? On the resort, is it a new hand or an old hand?
No, it's still up, Chair. I want to comment on this because it is very, very broad. I'm just trying to understand the broadness of the implications with the additions now, where the additions in red from D on, where you are specifying. But I do notice you say including, which means the D, E, F, G, H is not an exclusive provisions. So I'm not sure whether it is desirable to put all those in, but I want to make the point that this is extremely broad. The definitions of emotional, verbal, psychological abuse, and it can surely cover all forms of other abuse that we are putting in as well, such as elder abuse. So I'm not opposed to it. I'm just wondering whether there are any unintended consequences of repeating it. Now, we've had the discussion around spiritual abuse, but can I just ask you, would this cover spiritual abuse?
Thank you very much, Mr. Robertson.
Well, Mr. Swart, it may to an extent covers spiritual abuse due to the fact that by virtue of the word including, but obviously if including is removed, it will only relate to the conduct that is defined in the paragraphs A to H. And there may be some other instances where emotional, verbal, or psychological abuse can take place, who does not, and that conduct doesn't fall within the ambit of the current definition. But again, like I said, the harm element, if it's included in the definition of Domestic Violence Act, or rather of domestic violence, will to a large extent mitigate some unintended consequences due to the fact that there must at least be some type of harm that the complainant suffers. If one look at some overseas legislation, they actually deal with emotional or psychological abuse, and most of the conduct that is currently here is included in such legislation. So the big question is, if we take out include, it's going to be a close category of conduct that is emotional or psychological abuse, and exclude others. And the other thing is probably the width of the current provision. But then my argument is always that the harm requirement to a large extent will mitigate its overbroadness and unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Swart.
No, Chair, I'm not suggesting remove the word including, but you see what's changed from last. If you can just go to the top, if you've added a number of additional words in the definition, the manipulating, threatening, offensive, and intimidating, those words are now added, which are also in themselves very broad. But Chair, I'm not going to, I think I'm happy with it at the moment. Let's leave it at this. We would just need to see if there are any unintended consequences going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark.
Okay, good morning, Chairperson, and to all. I'd just like to add that the initial concern around this clause, if you look at the original Act, the Domestic Violence Act, was the use of the word pattern and repetitive nature, because you had to prove what is a pattern and the repetitive nature thereof. And I would disagree that it would, I think, include spiritual abuse within this the context of this definition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, Honourable Swart, you are not opposed to it?
No, Chair, I'm not.
Thank you very much. Can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, and that is the definition of functionary. I did indicate previously in respect of the definition of educated that we must look at this definition specifically and possibly also to define the various functionaries that is included in the current clause. First one is a medical practitioner. My submission that it should be defined. Proposed definition is in footnote 19, which is currently on the screen. And that merely means that it's a person that's registered as a medical practitioner in terms of the Health Professions Act. The word health service provider, when I evaluated the Act over the course of this week and weekend, it's my submission that health service provider is problematic. A health service provider may include something like a hospital, probably something like a care facility, etc. A more appropriate definition to deal with that is the word healthcare personnel. And our healthcare personnel, there is a definition that deal with that. In legislation currently. We can probably just use the word healthcare personnel and use the definition as is indicated in footnote 20, namely that it is a person that's defined in section 1 of the National Healthcare Act who falls within a specific category of personnel designated by the Director General of Health in terms of a directive contemplated in section 18. In the start of the footnote, I do refer to who may be considered healthcare providers, people that practice acupuncture, homeopaths, neuropaths, therapeutic massage therapy, etc. So it's probably, according to me, necessary to restrict that to healthcare personnel. Social worker is obviously necessary. We can define it. There's already definitions on the statute book, and it is adopted for purposes of this bill, where it is defined, amongst others, as social worker contemplated in section 17 of the Social Service Professions Act. Official in the employ of a public health establishment is very broad, and it's my submission that this must also be defined to narrow its width. One must consider this in conjunction with section 2A of the bill, which imposes obligations on certain people to evaluate and report and then to render certain services to the victims of domestic violence. A possible definition is to again make it subject to certain persons or category or class of persons that is designated by the Director General of Health in terms of the directives contemplated in section 18B. I already dealt with the definition of educator, and then I also propose that a caregiver must be defined. And a caregiver can be defined as a person who is 18 years or older in relation to a child, or a person with a disability, or an older person who takes responsibilities for meeting the daily needs of or is in substantial contact with such a person. This is the current definition that is on the statute book. So my submission is retain the definition of educators, but also define the current functionaries that is included in the definition of functionary. And the second part of this definition, the B paragraph, is substantially similar to the current definition in the Act, but it differentiates, or rather narrow it down to a certain class of category of persons, and also certain people who is in a rather, sorry, first one is a certain class or category of persons, and it's also persons who's employed in a certain class or category of entities, and that must be designated by the minister, meaning the Minister of Justice by notice in the Gazette. I'm going to stop there.
Honorable Sword, can you lower your hand? Yes, thank you. Members, any comments? happy with what Mr. Roberts is proposing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Then the definition of harassment, option one is the current definition of harassment that is proposed by the bill. The definition of harassment is in line with that of the Protection of Harassment Act. My submission, however, is that since the drafting of the Harassment Act, there were substantial developments in legislation that deals with harassment and or stalking. So various amendments are proposed to the definition of harassment. First is more or less where there is conduct where a person follow, watching, perusing, or accosting a complainant or a related person or loitering at a certain place in the near vicinity of a complainant or a related person. And that conduct must inspire a belief in the complainant that he or she or a related person may be harmed or their property must be damaged. Paragraph B deals with the new technology. Current definition refers to telephone calls. Obviously, there's various other means how you can communicate with somebody else. You can use email as another form of communication. And the current paragraph B provides for that. However, current bill omitted repeated communications. My submission is that the qualifier of repeated contact or communication should to a large extent be retained where electronic communications is involved. Due to the fact that I don't think that one or even two communications can actually constitute harassment. And that is the difference mainly in relation to the current definition in the bill. Paragraph C deals with communications that is not an electronic form. That is where you can deliver letters, faxes, packages, or other kind of communications to a complainant and for harassing the complainant. Again, my submission is that repeated communication is necessary to establish harassment. A single sending of a letter or a package, etc., cannot per se be regarded as any form of harassment. In addition to the above paragraphs, certain other conduct has been included in the definition of harassment, which is also recognized in many foreign legislation. Amongst others, unauthorized access to complainant's communications. Amongst others, where a complainant is forced to give up a cell phone and a person looks through SMSs or WhatsApp messages, etc. Something that has become very prevalent is monitoring or tracking of a person's movements. Obviously, that is to monitor where a person is, and obviously in most instances technology can be used for such monitoring or tracking. I did previously explain that I previously did explain paragraph F, and that is where respondent will, amongst others, break open a cupboard of a complainant and then look at property or fill with certain property that's in the complainant's possession. If that takes place, obviously, without the complainant's permission. G deals exclusively with the interference with property, amongst others, where a person sabotage the brakes of a car. And paragraph H deals with disclosure of electronic communications to a complainant or cause a complainant to receive such a communication, which is abusive, degrading, offensive, humiliating, and all other types of harmful communications. Paragraph I deals with the fact where a person actually distributes very harmful material or very private material to another person about the complainant. That should also be covered according to my submissions. And any communication that inspires the belief of harm or damage to property must be inserted here as a form of harassment. My submission is that option two is the broader, better option. Some of the newly inserted provisions is contained in legislation of, amongst others, the Australian Capital Territories. And to an extent, it will provide wider protection. Thank you.
Members, any comments? Honorable Jela.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out, without differing from Mr. Robinson on option two, but I want to find out if I happen to, even if, you know, sometimes in the house there are those, the family, those disagreements between men, a husband and wife. If I happen to take my husband's phone and, you know, go through and check some other things, you know, and without his consent, would that be taken as amounting to harassment? And sometimes you are doing it because of not being happy about one or two things, and he becomes angry with me, and then he decided to say I'm harassing him. Is that can that be considered, or being, is it somewhere there in option two covered? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other member wants to comment on this one? Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I believe it is covered, amongst others, by paragraph D. One must also remember that communications is something that receives very high protection in terms of the Bill of Rights. It's also an offence to access somebody else's communications, rather to the extent that you intercept communications. For the current, or insofar as it related to the question, my submission is that it will be covered by paragraph D, amongst others. Yes, it may amount to harassment. And then again, if we qualify it with a harm requirement, there should be some harm associated therewith. Like I said, it's covered. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I take it that members don't have a problem with option two. Let's go to the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition is that of harm. Currently in the bill, it's defined as mental, psychological, physical, or economical harm. There is a suggestion, and I did raise it previously, that we can consider, on the one hand, try to get rid or excise a specific description of harm from the Domestic Violence Act, so that it does have an ordinary dictionary meaning. And that's basically it. It's my submission that mental, psychological, or physical economic harm is quite wide. But in the current Domestic Violence Act, and if one looks at, amongst others, I think it's the New Zealand Family Violence Act, the Australian Territory's various family violence legislation, no specific harm requirement is prescribed. They use, in most instances, abuse, like psychological abuse or physical abuse. So it's probably better to just leave it an open-ended definition that can be interpreted in according to its ordinary dictionary meaning. I believe Ms. Clark, if she's still there, can probably also give her input in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you. So we are proposing option one. Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, my submission is that we probably need to omit the definition of harm.
Okay.
It's option two. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Clark?
Thank you, Chairperson. I support Mr. Roberts' deletion of the definition of harm.
Thank you very much. Members?
Support that.
Honorable Breitenberg? Honorable Taylor, can you lower your hand?
I support that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Taylor, can you lower your hand? Thank you.
Sorry, Chair.
Thank you. The next one. Can you move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It's a new definition that is proposed, namely insertion of the definition of integrated electronic repository in the definition clause. One must remember that various provisions later on in the bill do refer to the electronic repository, and for interpretation purposes, it's probably better if we include a definition in this regard. I don't think it will cause any problems, but obviously it will facilitate interpretation. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any hands? None. Can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It's the definition of intimidation. It's the current definition of intimidation, which is mainly defined as uttering and conveying of a threat or causing a complainant to receive a threat that causes harm. Option two and option three has been proposed, and option two is quite wide. It's, amongst others, conveying a threat, of course, complaining to receive a threat or expose a complainant to any conduct which has the effect that complainant fears for his or her own safety or damage to property. The third definition, which is according to me more preferable, and intimidation is there defined as physical violence or damage to property belonging to a complainant, threats of such violence or damage to property, and also to deprive a complainant or other person of their liberty or threatening to do so. And then it's further qualified with the last paragraph of the definition, where it stipulates that such conduct must be intended to compel the complainant to abstain from doing anything that there's a rightful or he has a right to do, or to do anything which he or she can refuse to do. So my submission is that option three is probably the better option, and I'll stop there.
Thank you. Any comments, members? Okay, can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next amendment relates to the definition of a person in a close relationship. One must remember that this definition is quite relevant, amongst others, to the definition of a person in a domestic relationship with a person. And it also relates, amongst others, to further conduct that constitute domestic violence. Currently, it's defined as there must be some kind of relationship between persons, and a court must consider the criteria that's set out in paragraph A to E, namely the degree of trust between the persons, even the level of dependence and commitment to each other, the length of time that the relationship existed, frequency of contact between persons, and a degree of intimacy between the persons. And a court must then, on the basis of this criteria, find whether a person is in close relationship with another person. So it's a new definition, and it's my submission that it probably needs to be inserted. There is a current definition that was proposed in the bill, which is quite narrow in this regard. It merely relates to another person that is part of the family or household of another person, or any other person in a close relationship to a person, without actually giving meat or substance to what other person, or rather what other criteria a person must be complied with to be regarded as a person in a close relationship with the complainant. I take it that there's no objection for inserting this definition in the bill?
Wait a bit, Honorable Sart.
Chair, I'm just looking at the definition in a close relationship, the degree of trust. So do I understand correctly that one adds all these together, because I'm just considering a employer-employee relationship where there's a large level of trust. Does that mean this is now extended to that relationship, which might be an unintended consequence? We're looking at domestic violence here, not the broader issue. Degree of trust between persons, to me, is very broad. When I give that example, what even in a parliamentary setup, the degree of trust in a political party, is there not an unintended consequence there? Or are these factors all to be read together? Or is it one? I see the person in a close relationship with regard to the following criteria, the degree of trust. So I'm not objecting to it, I just want to understand it better. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Clark?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I may respond. It would be read, as I said, conjunctively, as you see that the word and is used between paragraphs D and E. So it would be a collective, the criteria are seen collectively and not individually. And I think just to add that it is to address a challenge that's currently being experienced where people are making abuse of applying for protection orders where there are, for example, tenants on the same property and trying to prevent eviction from the property by saying, by applying for protection from for a protection order, by saying that they're in a relationship. The way that it's framed now would exclude that abuse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Swart, is that, are you covered now? Or is it clearer now?
Yes, thank you, Chair. The and makes a big difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There is no further input on this issue. Can we go to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next amendment that's proposed relates to physical abuse that constitutes conduct that qualifies as domestic violence. Again, it's quite a broad one due to the fact that the word includes is used, and it then prescribed that physical abuse includes physical violence or threats of physical violence, and it then also inserted new other very relevant criteria or actions which can obviously be brought within the ambit of the conduct that constitutes physical abuse. One is to deprive a complainant of his or her liberty or threatening to do so. It's like locking a person up in a room. And then it also deals with the administering of certain substances, which may be drugs or medicines or other chemicals, as contemplated in paragraph C, that is harmful to the complainant. And then also, amongst others, to withhold or threaten to withhold the complainant's medication that has been included. So it merely extends the current definition to include certain relevant conduct that constitutes physical abuse, but again, I must refer to the fact that it is an open-ended definition since includes is used. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments, members? Honourable Swart?
Yeah, I think this is where I raised the concerns about the parent-child relationship, and I want to make it very clear that I do understand that there are other ways of disciplining children, but there are, if you were to, for example, say, if you don't do this, I will smack you. Now, I'm aware of the Constitutional Court ruling, but I wanted, I think we, Chair, you asked Mr. Robertson to look at this aspect. I'm not sure if it comes in here, but it is something that we would need to look very carefully at for any unintended consequences in that relationship, because my understanding is that the parent-child relationship does fall under the definition, correctly so, because I think there could be actual situations of domestic violence in that regard. But I think we need to just understand whether the unintended consequences.
Thank you very much. Honorable Newport, questions?
Thank you, Chair. In the last paragraph D, withholding or threatening to withhold the complainant's medication. Let me ask my question first. If a person gives more than prescribed medication to the complainant, So we have withholding, but if the person gives more than prescribed medication and the complainant doesn't know, is that covered in the definition of physical violence? In the other paragraphs, is that covered?
Thank you very much. Let's start with the concern of Mr. Swart, then we'll come back to Honorable Wood. Mr. Robertson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. First, the concern of Mr. Swart. Obviously, physical abuse to an extent, or even face of physical violence, can take place in a parent-child relationship. We deal here with physical violence. So it's something that can be interpreted, amongst others, to be something on the level of assault, which is an offense in South African law, but it can be something less. But the concerns has been noted that not specifically here, but in respect of other conduct that constitutes domestic violence, that it may be brought and it may affect a parent-child relationship due to the fact that it may include certain compulsive behavior in order to discipline a child. But again, my submission is if we require harm in respect of all conduct of domestic violence in terms of this act, there must be some demonstrable harm. Amongst others, if a child go to a magistrate and apply for a protection order on the fact that his dad told him to isolate himself in a room for 2 days due to the fact that he was naughty, that must again also be considered whether the harm is reasonable or not. And the harm requirement may, to a large extent, mitigate the broadness in this regard. Regarding the second question, where an overdose of medicine is provided to a complainant, like indicated, it's an open-ended definition. It includes, amongst others, all that is listed in paragraphs A to D, but it also includes some other conduct of a physical nature that can be harmful to a complainant. So my submission is that it will be included under this specific definition. Thank you.
Thank you. And I will start. Can you lower your hand, or is it a new hand?
So yeah, I just want to say I hear what is being said, and I think I like the qualification relating to harm. I also believe that a strong argument could also be made out under the de minimis rule, where in cases like that as well, where probably there would not be a prosecution. So yes, I'm satisfied so far, but I would like to look at this more carefully. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And I believe what reference are you covered?
Yes, Chair, I'm covered. Thank you.
Thank you. Next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. And that relates to the current definition of related person that's in the bill and provides that it's a member of the family or household of a complainant or a person in a close relationship with a complainant. I did previously indicate close relationship is now more readily ascertained according to the definition criteria. And a related person is also very relevant in respect of related person abuse. One must remember in the current bill, certain conduct that can be committed against a complainant can also be committed against a related person And my submission is that a related person is a complainant in own right. And that was removed in the various new proposals that were made in terms of this working document. But yes, there is a need to address related person abuse, and that is why the new grant of domestic violence is then created of related person abuse. And that's mainly where a complainant is threatened with harm to a related person, or where a related person is threatened with certain harm, or where a person commits certain conduct that's harmful to a related person. And the qualifier in this grant of domestic violence is the last paragraph, where such actions can, in circumstances, be regarded as abuse to cause harm to the complainant. That was the aspect that was not in the current bill. But I believe currently it does address conduct that should be included as domestic violence, due to the fact that the related person is not always a person that is part of the family or household of complainant, amongst others. It can be a person a new life partner of a complainant, etc. So this must be evaluated then as a new ground of domestic violence, that the definition of domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any comments? No. Can you press it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The definition of residence was to an extent previously already explained, and that was in relation to a domestic relationship. We're going to discuss it in detail again, but it mainly give you indication what is for purposes of the Domestic Violence Act defined as to include a residence. And obviously I did try to accommodate almost all structures that can be used in a domestic relationship. Say house, a room, a shed, a hut, a tent, a mobile home, caravan, and any other place. It's also very relevant to, amongst others, the new powers that's afforded to the police to access private residents to obtain certain evidence in connection with domestic violence. I think there was no objection previously against this definition, so I'll go over to the next definition.
Before you move,
currently, in terms of the domestic violence,
Mr. Roberts, before you move, I think I need to double check, because there might not be another opportunity to come back at these things. Members, do you have any comments? Mr. Swart?
Sorry, I just was wondering, if you say means as opposed to includes, should there be something that's not there? Means. If you said includes, would it not be better? Because there could be some form of some structure. People live under pieces of plastic, sadly. Would it be better to say includes, or would it be better to say means?
Well, this is what I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Mr. Roberts, wait a bit. Honorable Nivo Drachens.
Thank you, Chair. I'm fine with resident, but I saw at the bottom that it says a new proposal. So I'm not sure if I missed something. Yes, where it says new proposal. Just want to check, did I miss anything there in the definition?
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It can be defined, amongst others, to include any part of any structure. But any structure is already very widely defined. So if the current definition means any part of any structure, and structure obviously got a dictionary meaning, it's already wide enough. But I will consider to broaden this definition to accommodate Mr. Swart and consider maybe to ensure that the word includes is used in the definition. So I'll try to make it broader. Regarding the new proposal, that relates to the definition of respondent. Currently, in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, a respondent is a person who's in a domestic relationship with a complainant and who commits act of domestic violence against the complainant. If one look at some trends that recently resolved, there is various instances where some respondents or person who commit domestic violence do not commit it themselves. They make use of third persons to commit acts of domestic violence. Some legislation, overseas legislation, do include the co-perpetrators in terms under their domestic violence laws. In South Africa, the effect is that respondent will be subject to the Domestic Violence Act, but a separate application needs to be launched against the co-perpetrator under the Protection of Harassment Act. Even if one look at the final, or rather the issuing of a final order in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, a court can prohibit a respondent unless the help of other persons to commit an act of domestic violence. It's my submission that it's not very clear whether where there is use of the third party, whether such third parties may in addition to the respondent be cited in domestic violence matters, and whether the Protection of Harassment Act must then be used to address the conduct of co-respondents. The proposed definition make provision that a co-respondent can be used to commit acts of domestic violence. And a proposed definition of a co-respondent can be a person that is not in a domestic relationship with the complainant and to conspire with or is procured by the respondent to commit an act of domestic violence. And then that person must actually commit an act of domestic violence to qualify as a co-respondent. If third parties is included under the Domestic Violence Act, there may be some procedural implications, but in any case, if there is a need to prohibit third parties from committing acts of domestic violence, the complainant must, in any event, resort to the Protection of Harassment Act to deal with to deal with such conduct. So it's something to be considered. My submission is that there is probably a need to include or make provision for third party committed domestic violence to deal with such aspects. Other legislation of other countries do provide for that, and that's done under the term associated respondents. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Nicholas.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Mr. Roberts, sir, for that. I do support then that the co-respondent definition should stay in the Act. And then, so I just wanted to check, you know, if a husband gets somebody else to kill his wife, for example, that it qualifies as murder, so it wouldn't really be harassment. You know, so because of those kind of situations, I really do support keeping that definition in this Domestic Violence Act. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Other members? Okay. So this definition stands. Can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Sexual abuse is the definition with the minor amendment that is currently in the bill. Sexual harassment, I think in a previous occasion it was it was already explained. There is some minor amendments to the current definition of bill to clarify it. I'm not going to deal with this matter in depth. Spiritual abuse was a matter that received attention.
Sorry, Mr. Roberts. Members, are we fine with the previous definition? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You can proceed. Mr. Roberts, you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Sorry, network problems. The current definition in the bill of that defines spiritual abuse was previously discussed in the committee, and Mr. Swart, amongst others, proposed an amendment to the current provision that is incorporated here as spiritual abuse. And what Mr. Swart proposed was that spiritual abuse means, amongst others, to advocate hatred against a complainant because of his or her religious or spiritual beliefs that constitute incitement to cause harm to the complainant, or to prevent the complainant from exercising his or her right of freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief, and opinion, to give external manifestation to his or her religious or spiritual convictions and beliefs, or thirdly, the conduct that where a complainant's religious or spiritual convictions and beliefs is used to justify or rationalize abusing the complainant. Mr. Swart previously did raise the issue that the current definition of spiritual abuse may be too wide and may give rise to constitutional issues. I think at the heart of the matter previously was, amongst others, the case of freedom of religion of South Africa versus the Minister of Justice, where moderate or reasonable chastisement by a parent of a child was declared unconstitutional. I must also refer, amongst others, to the Prince judgment. I think it was the first Prince judgment, where there was also a pronunciation by the Constitutional Court to the effect that religion or the rights in the constitution that deals with religion may be limited, amongst others, to protect others against harm. And in relation to the Prince judgment, it relates to the use of cannabis by Rastafarians. So two options is before the committee for consideration. The one that is proposed by Mr. Swart and the one that's currently in the bill. Thank you.
Can you go to the first one, the first option? Okay, thank you. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, since we've last discussed these proposals, we've got various amendments now to the definition of domestic violence, under which this is one of the many definitions. And as Mr. Robertson and Ms. Clark indicated earlier, the definition that is contained under emotional, verbal, and psychological abuse is now broader, and it includes spiritual abuse. You've also got a number of other definitions, including the catch-all phrase, which includes spiritual abuse. So I want to add a third definition, which is delete spiritual abuse, because I don't think it's necessary at all, in view that this is sufficiently covered by all the other definitions, including in the Principal Act and including in a number of other acts. However, should colleagues, as they approached it with the older person's bill, elderly abuse, want a belts and braces approach, then I do understand, and my second option would be then to go with the my proposal, which is in terms of the Constitution, which makes it very clear what we are talking about and would, in my view, not breach the rights of religious freedoms, because I'm concerned about unintended consequences where there might be a discussion of a religious nature in a household where you might have a person or a child who is totally atheist, and there's an exchange of ideas. And I think that that would be already covered if there was any harm caused under psychological, emotional, intimidation, harassment, or the extended versions. I don't think that it is necessary to put this in. But Chair, I leave it in the hands of the committee, but I do, my first option is delete this provision. It's not necessary. The second option would be to go with my option. I thank you, Chair.
Sorry, Honourable Swart, which will be option, your option will be option two?
That's correct, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Jayla.
Thank you, Chairperson. Option two, can you go down a little bit? I think this one, Chair, we have worked on this one because we did include some of the ways that we wanted to put here when we were working on it. I think this option two does covers me.
So we are covered by option two.
Yes, yes. I'm still trying to put this, understand this, Chairperson. See if maybe, because I'm not sure. I want to make sure that this issue of the practices, I'm not sure, Mr. Robinson will assist me if I'm covered here. Because my main issue about this option, it was the previous option, was that I wanted the issue of the abuse that is happening within the practices of these where the spiritual trainings are taking place and all that, You should have seen that also on TV the other day when the house of where there's training happening, and people were feeling that they've been abused, they've been beaten and all that. So I wanted to see if in this option, are we covered? Because my abuse was on that part, mostly Chairperson, without interfering with other people's religions.
Yes, and we must always bear in mind that we are dealing with spiritual abuse within the confines of domestic violence.
Yes, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Yako.
Thank you. I think also to just agree with Honorable Maseko Jele that I do agree with option two, and I do agree with option C, because I think it's very broad in how it covers abuse in terms of religious or cultural practices. So I think it's not per se to say a certain religion, but it covers the context of how at times religion can be used to perpetuate abuse against women. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Yako. Honorable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I also want to express my support for option two there, but would want to maybe just inquire also from Mr. Roberts whether using there in subclause C, the word using, is the way to go. The way I understand the subsection C, that it ultimately, to my mind, talks a bit about manipulation. But I also, obviously, using is a bit broader, but taking into consideration the concerns raised by the Honorable Swart, whether one shouldn't contemplate rather than making use of the term using, limited to manipulating the complainant's religious and spiritual convictions and beliefs to justify or rationalize abusing the complainant. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Newwood Strachan.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to say thank you to Honorable Swart for being willing to draft or assist with option two. I do know that he does have his reservations in terms of spiritual abuse, but I think the point is that it does happen. It can happen. We have a constitution, but even religious sectors deviate from the constitution, which causes harm and abuse to the victims. So I will support option two, but I did want to ask, nothing there mentions where people in the religious sector economically abuses people. Like, for example, the situation where, you know, they ask for money. People's pensions were lost because they were giving money to the church. So I don't see that coming in terms of the spiritual abuse.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. First, let's deal with economic abuse. In a religious environment, although not included under spiritual abuse, it may amount, amongst others, to economic abuse. But again, the Chairperson already indicated it must be abuse in a domestic violence relationship. Regarding the reference to beating or violence in the religion that was raised, this is not covered under spiritual abuse, and one needs to resort, amongst others, to physical abuse. But if it takes place in a domestic violence setup, one can probably be argue that the white paragraph C may include violence in a domestic violence relationship. It's like the reference to spare the rod and spoil the child, or any violence that has got a religious undertone will be covered by paragraph C. I don't exactly understand Mr. Horn's reference. I think, can you just repeat, Mr. Horn? You said something like means using, and it was not correct, and I lost what you said after that. Can you just clarify it, please?
Chair, may I proceed?
Yes, you can.
Okay, yes. Now, Mr. Roberts, just taking into account Mr. Swart's reservations, I was wondering whether the term using there at the beginning of subsection C could not be replaced with a more, I want to say, limited term of manipulating the complainant's religious or spiritual convictions. It's just an attempt to look into his reservations. It's not that I necessarily are not in support of the term using, but it might be broader than the term manipulating. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. One can probably use manipulating, but the underlying basis here is that the religious belief of complaining is used to justify certain abusing conduct. I think the word using is probably more adequate in this regard. It doesn't actually relate to manipulation of the religious and spiritual convictions, but since that manipulation ought to actually relate to the complainant, but this relate to religion that is used as a basis to justify or rationalize the abusing of the complainant. So my submission is the current wording is probably adequate and more appropriate in the context of that paragraph. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swart.
Between a rock and a hard place, because I'm trying to assist the committee with a definition which I'm opposed to. So option three is delete. I appreciate my colleague's support for my attempt to try to capture something more narrower, and Mr. Horn's suggestion is helpful as well, manipulating, but I need to also just record a reservation that particularly such as the example used by Mr. Roberts, where a parent would say, spare the rod and spank the child. In that context, clearly, we from our perspective would have a problem with that being applied. However, I want to assist the committee with this definition, and I appreciate colleagues' support, but I do need to also reserve that my first option is option three, which is delete, but if you'd allow me to reserve my position as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Jala, is your hand still up? Is it an old hand or a new hand?
Can I make a comment, Chair, a bit? I understand a little bit of Mr. Swart's reservations on this one. Because of the example of Mr. Robertson, I think I'm also not comfortable with his example. I don't think that here, to me, it will mean that. So that is why maybe Mr. Honorable Swart will have a reservation because of his example. So I was saying for now, let's put the example aside and concentrate on this one. I agree with this one, Jefferson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. third definition is the definition of weapon in the Act. In terms of the definition, a weapon is air gun, ammunition, or firearms, and any object other than a firearm which can be used to inflict a grievous bodily harm. One must remember that further on in the Act, the court has certain powers in terms of protection order, amongst others, that certain weapons, or weapons rather, can be confiscated by a police official if certain circumstances is met. However, something during the division that came to my mind is the fact that there's various other harmful, let's call it harmful, again, let's call it objects other than weapons that can be used in a domestic relationship. Amongst others, sulfuric acid that, or swimming pool acid that is at home, also maybe something like a substance that can be called a date rape drug. It's also harmful communications or very private information of a complainant that is very relevant to the domestic violence against which a protection order is granted. My submission is, by virtue of the reference to a weapon and an object, and the explanation later on in the Domestic Violence Act where a police official may seize such objects, that we actually do leave out this other harmful objects that can be used to commit domestic violence. Like I said, swimming pool acid can arguably be regarded as a substance that inflicts grievous bodily harm if that is used or thrown in the face of a complainant, and then also certain medication and certain porn videos or private information that relates to domestic violence. So the question to be decided on is whether we need to include such other substances, objects, or etc. That cannot be brought under the definition of weapon in the bill, and to make provision that the court may order that such objects or chemicals or medicines or communications may also be confiscated. One must remember that the powers to confiscate certain objects must specifically be authorized by legislation. Otherwise, I do not think that one can bring it within the ambit of the current provisions of the Domestic Violence Act. So this is something that needs to be clarified, and I put it to the committee for decision in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jela.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if this issue, I mean to say, be on the any object. Can we, in reference to age, Chairperson, because I can see there we have mentioned the air gun, ammunition, and all that. We have also this weapon that is called traditional weapon. Can we include it there, where we mention the weapons and all that, rather than putting it any object, something like that? But because we know that we normally talk about the traditional weapons and all that, where can we fit that one? Can we fit it on somewhere there or what? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I believe traditional weapon will be included under any object, since a traditional weapon is something that can be used to inflict grievous bodily harm or a dangerous wound if it is used to commit an assault. But like again, I said, it's an object. Object is usually something amongst others, other than date rape medication or something that do not inflict grievous bodily harm, but can have serious or can cause serious harm to a complainant, amongst others, a certain intimate videos or very private information. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Nebotlachen.
Chairperson, I just need clarity. So I wanted clarity on B. I would like B to stay there as any object or any or other than that which is referred to, because sexual violence, other objects are used in sexual violence. So it's not only as in A, as it's stated in A, but I wanted clarity on that, because does B then cover that which I mentioned?
Thank you. Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, object in B was qualified to the extent that it must be used to inflict grievous bodily harm or a dangerous wound. Obviously, let's say something like compelled sexual assault with an object is probably excluded, again, from this definition, since it doesn't inflict a grievous bodily harm or a dangerous wound. Or let me rather say it may not. So that is one of the categories of objects that do not resort under weapon. And that is why I did propagate that we probably should consider extension of the orders of a court in terms of Section 7.2 of the Domestic Violence Act in certain circumstances to also authorize the police to confiscate certain objects or material that is very relevant to domestic violence before the court, and which can be used, amongst others, to inflict grave psychological or emotional harm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think just to put it into context, the definition of weapon is also to replace the archaic definition of arm in the existing Act, and it should also be read together with Section
9. I can't hear you properly. There's a problem with your sound.
My apologies for that. Is that better, sir?
Yeah, that's better.
Thank you, sir. The definition of weapon should just be also seen within the context of replacing the definition of arm, which is in the existing Act, which is an archaic description, and should also be seen in relation to the existing Section 9, which deals with seizure of arms and what currently is seizure of arms and dangerous weapons, and has now been consolidated as seizure of weapons. I think that the only concern, and perhaps what should be borne in mind, is if one broadens it too widely, one would be including the seizure of almost anything. So, for example, although pool acid could be used, that would be a household item that could be normally used for a legitimate purpose, whereas a firearm and a dangerous weapon, such as a traditional weapon, could be used for direct physical violence. So one must just bear in mind that it may go much wider and broader and allow the police to have too far-reaching powers in terms of what they may then seize. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, are we fine with the definition as it has been explained? move to the next one.
Mr. Chairperson, so the effect is that we do not extend or need to add a provision to also provide for the seizure of other objects that is extremely harmful, that doesn't cause a grievous bodily harm or dangerous wound, and that we're only going to concentrate on weapon as a firearm or object and not to extend it. Okay, we are, next provision relates to more or less the content of the bill that provides for the actual domestic violence provisions. Subsection 2A was inserted to deal, amongst others, with the obligations that is imposed on functionaries where they, in the course of their performance of their duties and functions, obtain information that older person, a child, or a person of a disability were subject to acts of domestic violence. I believe most of the amendments indicated in the writ was explained previously. I must just remember that the criminalization provision in respect of 2A was removed, and previously it was argued that any failure or non-compliance with this duty or function will be regulated by directives in terms of section 18B of the Act, and it may lead to disciplinary steps to be instituted. The proposed section 2B deals with obligations regarding reporting of family violence that involves a child, a person with a disability or an older person. And it was explained previously, but something that must still be considered by the committee and which was discussed previously is the criminalization of a failure to report incidents of domestic violence. If one look at the current legislation, amongst others, the Older Persons Act, the Children's Act, and the Mental Health Act, it's only the Older Persons Act that criminalise the non-reporting of abuse of an older person. Mental Health Care Act, in respect of a mental health care user, or the Children's Act, does not impose a reporting obligation that is subject to criminalization. Some of the concerns that were previously raised in the committee against a criminalization is, amongst others, that the current definitions of domestic violence is to the effect that it involves elements that may be subjective and objectively it cannot in all instances be evaluated as a domestic violence. Furthermore, there is also was the criticism that there is persons that assist victims of domestic violence in respect of such behavior. There is, amongst others, certain confidentiality obligations in terms of legislation that must be kept by a person. And it's also the criticism was raised to the effect that persons that actually do provide support services to a victim of domestic violence will be criminalized if they don't report it. One can, amongst others, refer to the incidents where a child is the victim of domestic violence, and there will be obligation on the mother then to report it. And if she doesn't report it, obviously she will be guilty of an offense. So that is the only aspect that really needs consideration in respect of the proposed clause 2B. And if we keep the current
Mr. Robertson?
Hello, can you hear me, Mr. Chairperson?
No, got cut.
Mr. Chairperson?
Yeah, can you start from the beginning of the sentence?
Okay. In respect of the proposed clause 2B, the clause, amongst others, provides for criminal offence if a person does not report the incident of domestic violence against a child, an older person, or a mental health care user. If one look at, amongst others, the Older Persons Act, the Children's Act, and the Mental Health Care Act, it is under the Older Persons Act that criminalizes the failure to report abuse of an older person, and not the other two pieces of legislation. The criminalization of non-reporting was previously criticized during the public consultation process. Some of the arguments that were raised in support of such criticism is to the effect that some incidents of domestic violence is quite vague, and it's difficult for a person to, on face value, to regard that as domestic violence, amongst others, that there is a mental element that must be complied with. Other criticisms against the criminalization is that certain persons that provide services to a victim of domestic violence provide such services usually in terms of confidentiality, but if it's criminalized, they must report it. The adverse consequences, amongst others, reported out where a person is approached by a victim and that person assists the victim. In terms of this obligation, he must report it. There was also a reference to the fact that in a domestic relationship where a mother is already a victim of domestic violence, if there's domestic violence against a child, the mother will commit an offense if she does not report domestic violence in that circumstances. Another suggestion that was made were, amongst others, to the effect that only real serious conduct of domestic violence should be reported or subject to a compulsory reporting requirement where there is a real danger of physical harm to a complainant. And it was also pointed out that if each and every conduct that is perceivable domestic violence is reported, it may lead to a system overload and any measure that may be used to address domestic violence. So the question before the committee is, must we continue with the criminalization of non-reporting of incidents of domestic violence, or should we exclude that from section 2B? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Members, that is the question that needs guidance from members. Honorable Swart, followed by Honorable Horn.
Chair, I think this is a very difficult question and we will need to ponder on it. On the one hand, I fully understand the need to encourage people to report domestic violence, particularly in the circumstances set out in this section. However, to then criminalize the non-reporting might well have the opposite effect. So I'm not sure. I think we will see unintended consequences. However, at the same time, to ensure that a person who should report issues does report issues. So I'm a bit on either side at this stage. I'd be guided by other colleagues because I understand the fact that maybe today many people that should report issues don't report issues. And I think that's where colleagues might say, but in view of the fact that people that are aware of domestic violence, they choose to just ignore it and people's lives are then lost. And maybe there is an obligation then to report it. So, Chair, this is quite a complicated issue, but I'd like to hear what other members say on this.
Thank you. Honourable Khan.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I agree with the Honourable Swart. From my side, I'm of the view that it is advisable that we include an obligation to report in the bill. But I am not in favour of criminalising those who fail to comply with the obligation to report. I honestly believe that it will have an adverse or a chilling effect ultimately in terms of people's willingness to involve themselves in a constructive manner where there are issues in their immediate circle with in respect of domestic violence. And in addition to that, and I think we heard ample, evidence to that effect during the public hearings, I think we might have a situation where both the willingness of people within a social circle or a neighborhood to involve social services and the complexities around the work social services in respect of these issues, it will just become intolerable and that much more complex if we are to criminalize a failure to report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm with the previous two speakers. I'm very, very hesitant to criminalize this issue. I would certainly want to give it some more thought. I'm not rejecting it, and I'm not sure that you couldn't try and word it in a way that makes the obligation perhaps less onerous, but I'm very hesitant to draft legislation now that criminalizes such an action. I do think we need to think about this very, very carefully. For the moment, I'm not really willing to support it.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jella.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I agree with my colleagues. It's kind of difficult, but it's necessary also to encourage the community to report. Maybe and Mr. Robertson, I can also maybe also continue also in also finding some ways that we can also maybe replace in terms of this issue of reporting, criminalizing this issue of reporting. Again, Chair, I wanted to. I'm saying also other members of the community, as we'll come back to it later. But I also wanted to raise the issue on the very same issue of reporting on the side of there are some occasions where people do report such incidences to the police, and they expect that the police keep this a secret so that the whoever is involved, a perpetrator, may not know about them. You find that at the later stage, the reporter is being revealed. The perpetrator knows exactly what happened
and the person comes and intimidate this the reporter, the person who has reported the matter. So I wanted to find out how can we assist the in relation with the very same one, the number four of criminalizing the whole thing. How do can we assist also in terms of the chair? That's the request that I would want us to look into also. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nivo Tahans.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, it is a very complex matter because, you know, we have to understand the socioeconomic situation, the family pressures, all those issues, and that could all play a part in the non-reporting, you know, the effects of it are countless. But somewhere there should be some form of encouragement for people to report or an obligation for people to report. And, you know, we need to strongly express that perhaps if a social worker knows or a teacher knows or a doctor who examines a person knows, then yes, they have confidentiality obligation, but there should also be some kind of obligation for them to report, for then the police to take it further. So, yeah, it is rather a difficult one to figure out.
So there is no disagreement on the duty to report. The issue is criminalizing the failure to report, and that is what members want to think about it further. Is that a correct summation of the issue, members?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you. We will come back to it on Tuesday, in fact, our next meeting. But I think, Mr. Roberts, if you can draft something on the issue of duty to report. I think we can have two options. One option is the one of criminal failure to report, creating a criminal offense, and then the other one without a criminal offense, but encouraging or imposing a duty to report, especially by professionals, as Honorable Walter said, professionals like doctors, social workers, who must have that duty to report. And let's come back to it later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Just in respect of the obligations of other persons, such as doctors and other people, to an extent, I believe that Clause 2A do regulate this. So, but yes, I do take cognizance of the fact that we probably need another option for consideration. No criminal offence with encouraging measures to facilitate reporting. I will give effect there too.
Thank you. Honorable Breitenberg and Honorable Chair, can you lower your hands?
Sorry.
Thank you. And you can proceed, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The proposed Section 3 provides for arrest by a peace officer without a warrant of arrest. The police did raise a lot of issues in this regard. And the first one is, amongst others, the arresting of a person at the scene of domestic violence in respect of some conduct that falls within the definition of domestic violence and which constitutes an offence in terms of any law, and also then the arrest of a person who contravenes a protection order. In terms of the Domestic Violence Act, a person who where there's a contravention of a protection order, the complainant must give you affidavit and the final protection or interim protection order to the police official, who may then arrest the person. So paragraph B seems to be a contradictory statement in respect of that obligations, since arrest in respect of a contravention of a protection order can take place without complying with the other requirements in the Act to ensure that such a person is brought before the court. So the issues to be addressed is, firstly, do we need this offence regarding a contravention of a protection order, as in paragraph B of subsection 1? And the other issue is the broadness of the powers that is afforded to police officials to arrest any person, or sorry, any respondent. Currently in the bill, it's a person. That can be. The question is this not also kind of too broad? One must also take into account Section 40 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which do provide that a peace officer may, without a warrant of arrest, arrest a person for a suspected offence of the arrest of kids, something like assault, malicious.
We are cutting. Can you repeat your last sentence?
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Sorry. In respect of paragraph A, the question which can be raised is, do we actually need to afford powers to police officials to arrest a person for any offence? Without a warrant can be accommodated within an act of domestic violence. Obviously, a qualifier is offence in terms of any law. So you will afford a police official, amongst others, the powers to arrest the person for crime injuria. I want to refer the committee to Section 40 of the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 41, who, amongst others, provides that a police official may arrest the person who he or she respects on reasonable grounds to have committed a Schedule 1 offence. And in Schedule 1, the offences of assault, malicious injury of property is listed there. So my concern is basically the broadness and possible abuse that may result from the arrest of a person who commits an offence that's probably domestic violence, and one must read that in conjunction with the Criminal Law and Related Matters Amendment Bill that was approved by the committee, which places very onerous bail application, bail conditions, or rather conditions for application of bail on such a person. So question one is, do we need subsection 1A, and the second one is, in light of other provisions of the Domestic Violence Act that requires a specific procedure before a person can be arrested for contravening a protection order, whether paragraph B is not in conflict with that obligation or provisions. So that's just the two questions in respect of subparagraph B subparagraph 1 that needs to be decided upon. I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. I have received a request for a 3-minute break, comfort break. Can you come back at 12:27? Is it fine?
Yes, Chair.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
Members, it's 12:30. Can I propose that at 1, maybe we have a break to allow members to go and eat? We are still going to sit for some time. I think we will finish in the evening. How many minutes do we think we must take for lunch? No, I don't. I think that we must encourage members to have stomach cramps. 10 minutes, I think it will be too little. Don't you think so, Honorable Jelle?
Yes.
Honorable Nivo Drachens?
Can I please request to make it 30 minutes because my interpreters are continuing throughout as well. When the one interpreter is not on screen, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are taking a break. They are sitting and listening. So especially if we're going to work up until the night. So can we please take 30 minutes?
30 minutes. Is that fine, members?
Agreed.
Thank you very much. So we'll adjourn at 1 for 30 minutes. You can proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
It was a question to members, yes.
Yes, in respect of Section 3.1 that provides for arrest without a warrant. Thank you.
Members, any comments? Honorable Chairman.
Thank you, Chairperson. The last time when Mr. Robertson left, he was also, he said something at the end about B. I'm not sure exactly. I don't remember very well. If maybe he can remind us. Just a summary, but all in all, Chair, I'm happy with this, the peace officer arresting without the warrant. But now, add an act of domestic violence, which constitutes any offense in terms of any law. I'm not sure because he also, or this one, do we choose between the two again? That's where I got confused a little bit. Maybe you can advise me on that one.
I think the issue was whether this section is at all necessary, whether we should not use the Criminal Procedure Act as it stands. Am I correct, Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, yes, there's two questions. The first is paragraph B that provides for arrest per offence referred to in section 17.1A of the DVA is committed. That is where a person contravenes a protection order. In other provisions later on, there's a specific procedure that needs to be followed in respect of a contravention of a protection order. The complainant must provide an affidavit to a police official as well as the protection order and specify that the respondent contravened the protection order. In respect of paragraph B, we now allow arrest without such procedures. So that's number one. Number two is mainly to the effect that yes, to arrest a person for offence that can be accommodated in terms of the definition of domestic violence may have the effect that it can include very minor offences or in the bill for which a person can be arrested without a warrant. Then I did refer to the Criminal Procedure Act that, amongst others, provides for the arrest of a person who committed an offence without a warrant on a reasonable suspicion, as referred to in Schedule 1, which includes, amongst others, assault and malicious injury to property. So the question is correct. Chairperson summarized it correct. Do we need this clause? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, a comment. Honorable Huang.
Yeah, Chair, I think that if this clause is not necessary, then we should not include it. It is not as if this bill, when it becomes an act, will work in isolation. And in saying that, I'm also still having this fear that if not very carefully phrased, if we choose to keep it in the bill, then it might lead to a situation where abuse may, and now I'm not talking domestic violence type of abuse, but abuse of processes and the law may be enabled. So I would rather opt then for leaving the discretionary powers of peace officers and the SAPs as formulated by way of current legislation. They hopefully have a clear and a proper understanding of their powers in terms of those legislation. And for us to have this in this bill could just muddy the waters to an extent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jala.
Maybe conclude, look into it when we discuss next time on like that, the other one.
Honorable Jala, can you, we can't hear you properly.
That Chair, I'm happy, but it's just that, you know, because of the, I thought that maybe, can we just go and think also, and so that we can be able to comment when we, I'm saying don't, let's give it time also, like the other one. When we come back, when we discuss, we conclude on the bill, so that we can also, as a committee also, get a final comment.
But members must bear in mind that we must not push too many issues backwards, because we are discussing now. What will happen when we come back, if we have too many issues, it will be difficult for us to finalize the bills. And we only have one sitting left before we vote on the bills. So we must bear that in mind, that we are still halfway through the bill. So if we keep on postponing a lot of issues, when we come back next week, we'll have a lot of issues that are outstanding that we would not be able to finish. Honorable Nivo Dachans.
Chair, can I say for now I agree with the Honorable Horn. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nivo Dachans.
Thank you, Chair. Well, knowing that gender-based violence in term and domestic violence is on the increase, and knowing that if a violent person is not removed immediately out of the situation, as does happen, the worst conclusions can happen to the family. I would prefer that this clause would stay as is for now. But if my colleagues agree on removing it, then so be it. Yeah.
Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is already a provision that that arrests can be made without a warrant if there's a reasonable suspicion that a crime is being committed or is about to be committed. So this may be unnecessary, and if it is unnecessary, and those are not my dogs, they're my neighbor's dogs. If it's not,
you sound too close to the call, Honorable Breitenbach.
Sorry?
They sound too close to the call to be your neighbor's dog.
Oh, wait, my neighbor's dogs are right outside my bedroom window. They're very beautiful dogs, and I visit them often, but they're not mine. If the clause is unnecessary, we should perhaps not put it in. It will just give unnecessary encouragement for abuse. So it's already a strike law that can be done. I'm not sure that it's necessary to put it in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clark.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I don't know whether a misunderstanding, but in terms of just the police's concerns that were raised in relation to Section 3 was really around being called out to a scene where a person has not committed the act of domestic violence in their presence. So the person may have, the call has been made, they've gone out to the scene, but they cannot arrest because the person is either not at the scene itself, because the current legislation requires that the person be at the scene. So that is why I think Mr. Roberts has included there the words "who attends the scene," so that if the person is hiding in the garden next door, they're able to go and effect the arrest. So I don't know if this is useful at all. Thank you.
So the issue, the differentiating issue here is who attends a scene of an incident of a domestic, in fact, who is not at the scene of the domestic violence at that time? Is that what you're saying, Ms. Clark?
Yes, sir, that is correct. So the person has heard the phone call and they've quickly fled next door, they're hiding in a field next door or in the home next door, then the police may not actually effect that arrest because it hasn't been committed in their presence as is required by Schedule 1.
So is what you're saying is that one is not provided for in the Criminal Procedure Act?
No, and it's not. It's a concern in terms of the current powers that the police have or the peace officer has in terms of the current Domestic Violence Act. That is a problem that has been highlighted by the police.
So you are suggesting that we leave it as it is, we don't delete it?
Well, not the whole of Section 3, no.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Swart.
See, I think that explanation is helpful because it does remind us of the concerns about, and I'm just trying to see about a police officer arriving at the scene after an incident of domestic violence has taken place and then to execute the warrant. So in view of that, we might need to give consideration to keeping it in. My initial concern was to have a provision which is basically the same as the provision in the Criminal Procedure Act, and that which has already been had jurisprudence on it, and now you've got a new clause, but this is slightly different, and I think that does warrant us reconsidering. Thank you, Jim. In other words, possibly leaving it in with those words in red that qualified.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Horn, and Honorable Jelle. Given the explanation, do you still hold the view that we should delete the paragraph?
No, I'm happy for it to stay.
Thank you.
Yes, agreed, Chair. Obviously, we will then talk about the options around the phrasing then.
Okay. Honorable Jelle?
I'm happy, Chair. I'm happy with the explanation that my clerk gave to us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Back to you, Mr. Roberts. Thank you, Ms. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Obviously, paragraph B must really be considered. You cannot have two procedures regarding a contravention of a protection order in a bill, one describing arrest without the other procedures, the other prescribing certain procedures for arrest. So we deal with that later on. Section 2 of the bill relates to the arrest by a peace officer of a person who is reasonable of suspecting to having committed an offence of domestic violence.
Sorry, Mr. Roberts. So you will provide us with something on B.
Yes, Mr. Jefferson, I'll provide something to that, but it is clear. I think it's we're going to deal with that provision later on when we discuss the bill, and I'll come back to this one. The current provision in the Domestic Violence Act gives the powers to a police official to arrest a person on a suspicion of acting committed domestic violence where physical violence is involved. The options 2 and 3 mainly just to clarify that provision further. It's my submission that the current provision as is in the bill is sufficient, and we probably don't need to deal with the option 2 and 3 in this regard. Although it was provided for the committee for consideration, I believe the current provision in the bill, subsection 2, doesn't give problems in practice. And the police did refer, amongst others, to incidents where there was self-defense. How do you determine it? And options 2 and 3 mainly try to put in certain options, providing belt and braces to ensure that there must at least be something like a reasonable suspicion or on reasonable grounds believe that a person has committed an offense as contemplated in that section. So my submission is that we can probably stay with option 2 unless Ms. Clark has got a different opinion in this regard. Thank you.
Ms. Clark?
I think that option 2 is a viable an option. I think the concern was really around option 1, where both parties would be at risk of being arrested if an obligation like this was placed on the peace officer.
Thank you very much, members. Are we fine with the option 2? I take it. Thank you. Can we proceed?
Mr. Chairperson, in respect of option 2, I did insert the word suspect. It was not in the document that was provided to the committee, so I'm going to put in suspects. It's a lesser onerous burden, and we then stay with on reasonable grounds beliefs of having committed an offence. Is that all right?
Okay. You've raised your hand.
Yes, sir, if I may, please. Just with regards to the use of the word person, that really opens up that the scope of arrest much wider. And perhaps that would just need consideration, because then it would be any person at the scene of the incident and not necessarily the person who's committed the act of domestic violence. And that would also then extend the powers of the police much wider than what they already have.
Okay. Mr. Robertson, can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. The remainder of Clause 3 was explained as mainly to provide for police officials or police officers as not police officials to render similar services at the scene of domestic violence to a complainant. Peace officers, among others, people that is designated in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act as peace officers. The clause 5 deals or afford police additional powers in respect of obtaining evidence. Currently, it is an exemption to Section 26 of the Criminal Procedure Act that provides that police may, without a warrant, gain access to a premises, but the owner must provide consent in respect thereof. The only real amendment thereto is to substitute the reference to dwelling with residence, since that is the terminology that is used in the context of the Domestic Violence Act. So throughout the clause where this is used, it's substituted with residence. Clause 6 deals with applications for protection orders. Amendments that were affected, amongst others, is that it provides for electronic procedure to apply for electronic, apply for a domestic violence interdict. And the various considerations were taken into account in finalizing this provision. The aspect that were previously put before the committee, amongst others, relate to Section 3B. Amongst others, that a person may, on behalf of a child who's under the age of 16 years, apply for an interdict. One must remember that paragraph A provides that application may be brought on behalf of the complainant, and it also do provide that there must be permission, I think, to the extent. Provision is now specifically made that a person may, without such permission, apply on behalf of a child who is under the age of 16 years if a court considers that application to be in the best interest of a child. So it's an exception that is created, and I believe that previously did spark of some discussion in the committee. And I think something that was referred to, amongst others, was that where there was a sexual assault, a child did not actually, in all instances, want to make such conduct known to other persons, and that a child should retain autonomy to make consideration whether other person can apply on his or her behalf for a domestic violence interdict. So that is an aspect. Are we going to keep the current B as is, with the incision in subparagraph 1? And that is the matter to be considered by the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nivo Drachens.
I'm okay with keeping that provision. I'm okay, but can you please go back up to the word mentally retarded? Is a no-no. We do not use that word, so please can you amend that? Use the proper terminology. Mentally retarded is not acceptable in the disabled community.
Can you suggest the correct terminology?
Mr. Chairperson, if I may intervene at this stage, I believe the wording appear between brackets and is in bold, so it's actually something that is repealed, amongst others, to get rid of the reference there. So it's repealed. It's a repealed part of that provision. It's not in the bill anymore if it's adopted by Parliament.
Okay, that's fine, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. So, Honorable Nevot references this section must stay. What is the view of other members? Honorable Jara?
Yes, I think I'll support Honorable Nevot Rahan.
Thank you. Can you move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next one, it's just something that was inserted in subsection 4. And if you look at some legislation in other countries, provision is made that a certain approved organization may, amongst others, make application on behalf of a child for a protection order. And South Africa, there's various organizations that is involved with children, and such organizations may assist children in applications. It's something to be considered. It was not in the document that was furnished to the committee, but from my view, it may be something that can be considered. I'm not going to belabor this point. The subsection 5 mainly provides for the consideration of applications outside ordinary court hours. There's just certain textual corrections that is affected. It is indicated in red. But on the other hand, the option 2 provides for certain specific criteria to determine whether there should be a consideration of the application outside ordinary court hours. And that is provided for in the option 2, namely that there must be prima facie evidence that there's domestic violence, and B is already in the previous provision, and that is that the complainant is suffering some form of harm, and that the domestic violence interdict is therefore immediate necessary for protection of the complication. Of the domestic violence incidents. So it's mainly additional factors that is provided regarding outside ordinary court hours applications. So that's basically the two options. Option one is the narrow provision, reasonable belief that a complainant is suffering or may suffer harm. The section 1 provides, amongst others, that there must be some evidence that there is domestic violence, and as a belief that domestic violence is committed, and thirdly that complainant may suffer hardship if it's not dealt with immediately. It's just to curb the influx of applications outside ordinary court hours. So it's either option 1 or option 2. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Which one would you prefer? Mr. Roberts, is option 2 not comprehensive enough? Mr. Roberts, sir?
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson. Option 2 makes provides certain other criteria that's not in the first option, the current option. So the current option makes it easier to apply for a domestic violence interdict. The second option prescribes certain other criteria that must be met before a person can make an after-hour application. And that is emanated from certain discussions with magistrates due to the fact that various applications are actually brought after hours. So it's the first one is it's brought, second one narrows it down. So that is the two options to be considered. Thank you.
Okay, members?
And let's take option two as advised.
Thank you. Is there an objection to option two?
Agreed, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we adjourn, members, until 1:30?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.